Welcome, everyone, to the 14th session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, Linda Graham will be teaching Neuroscience of Resilience and Post-Traumatic Growth. She's broadcasting live from San Rafael, California, while the Sounds True team and I are here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. And, if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce you to Linda Graham. Linda Graham, MFT, is an experienced psychotherapist in the San Francisco Bay Area, and she's a teacher of mindful self-compassion. She integrates modern neuroscience, mindfulness practices, and relational psychology in her international trainings. She is the author of Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. It was the winner of the 2013 Books for a Better Life, and it was also the 2014 Better Books for a Better World Award recipient. She publishes a monthly e-newsletter, Healing and Awakening into Aliveness and Wholeness, and weekly resources for recovering resilience, both of which are archived at lindagrahammft.net. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for participating in this exploration of the neuroscience of resilience and post-traumatic growth. And thanks to all the folks at Sounds True that make this training possible. So when we talk about the neuroscience of resilience and post-traumatic growth, we're really talking about neuroplasticity, the capacity innate in the brain to change and grow and learn from experience lifelong. And when necessary, the brain can rewire patterns that it has already learned in response to life events. It can create changes in its neural circuitry. It can integrate the functioning and processing of information from experience differently. And so to be able to create new patterns of response to life events and even rewire old responses to life events so we can learn from experience. We can become more resilient. We can respond well to anything catastrophic or traumatizing. We can cope and even thrive in this very challenging enterprise of being human. So neuroplasticity is a huge topic. It's the most exciting discovery of modern neuroscience in the last 150 years. So we're learning that we can identify the experiences that will harness the neuroplasticity of the brain to catalyze new learning and encode that learning in the neural circuitry of the brain so that we can develop and strengthen capacities in the brain that we want to when we know how. So I'm focusing specifically on strengthening the capacity of resilience, a capacity of response flexibility innate in the brain so that we can cope with the challenges and crises inevitable in life with more skill, adaptability, flexibility. Response flexibility is a capacity innate in the brain. It's one of the primary functions of the prefrontal cortex, the brain's center of executive functioning. So when we can strengthen the prefrontal cortex and the capacity of response flexibility, we're strengthening the capacities of resilience. And resilience is what will lead us in this training through the five processes of post-traumatic growth. So post-traumatic growth begins with trauma, which post-traumatic growth researchers define this way. Someone's just moving along in their life, and they experience an upheavaling event. They lose a job, they lose a relationship, they lose their home, they lose someone they love, and that event upends their sense of who they are and how the world works. There's a kind of shock of learning that bad things can happen to good people. It scrambles or even shatters their personal sense of identity. And there's a sense of no going back to life as it was before, that normal is never going to be what normal used to be. So the event can not only feel overwhelming, it can actually overwhelm the capacities of the person to cope, at least temporarily. And they may lose, at least temporarily, a sense of connection to community, to a sense of meaning, to a sense of possibility for the future. So these same post-traumatic growth researchers are defining post-traumatic growth as the learning and growth that happens in the journey of recovering from trauma. So they define it as positive changes experienced as a result of the struggle with a major life crisis or a traumatic event. So those changes can include an increased sense of one's personal strengths, the resilience. If I can live through that, I can live through anything. A sense of new opportunities, new possibilities that were not present in life before. Deeper relationships with people, whether close relationships or a deeper sense of common humanity, compassion for those who suffer. This deeper relating can extend even into a spiritual sense of being held by a universe that is much vaster and larger than we are. And there's a greater appreciation of life in general because of the journey of recovery from trauma, not just in spite of it. So these are among the outcomes that the five steps or processes of post-traumatic growth will lead us to. The last step in the process, greater appreciation of life because of the trauma, not just in spite of it, is key to understanding post-traumatic growth. So one of the pioneers of all this research, Richard Tedeschi at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, says because there is no returning to baseline for people whose worlds have been upended by trauma, a traumatic event is not simply a hardship to overcome. The trauma becomes a dividing line in people's lives. It can catalyze deep transformation. People do more than survive. They become wise. So this is not a training on trauma therapy per se. A skillful, successful body-based trauma therapy will certainly help people lead people to these outcomes of post-traumatic growth. But this training focuses on five processes of post-traumatic growth that a person can do on their own, outside of therapy or in addition to therapy, learning how to use the self-directed neuroplasticity of their brains to support and foster that post-traumatic growth. So there are three sections to this training today. One is learning how to prime the neuroplasticity of the prefrontal cortex, the brain's center of executive functioning, to support all the behaviors of response flexibility that we need for resilience and post-traumatic growth. Then I'll highlight some of the emerging shifts in our research-based understanding of resilience and trauma that are most relevant to post-traumatic growth. And we'll spend most of the time learning how to move through these five processes or steps of post-traumatic growth. Awareness and acceptance of reality, which is considered one of the most significant predictors of achieving high measures of post-traumatic growth. Resourcing with people, sharing the story, sharing the struggle. Resourcing with the positive and reframing the negative. Creating a new coherent narrative, a new life story. And then appreciating a new direction in life and taking action in that new direction in life because of the trauma, not in spite of it. There's a way in which these processes of post-traumatic growth have been expressed through literature, philosophy, spiritual traditions for eons. They could be said to be the natural focus of modern psychology and psychotherapy. We'll look at the special contribution of 30 years of post-traumatic growth research in generating a new field of treatment in psychotherapy. And we'll bring in some of the latest findings in neuroscience. Research measuring changes in brain structure in people who meet the measures for post-traumatic growth. All that research is less than 5 years old. It's very, very recent. And the measurements in the fMRI scanners of the resting state brains of people who score high in measures of post-traumatic growth are not yet sophisticated enough to determine causality, but they do indicate significant correlation between strength and functioning in the prefrontal cortex and post-traumatic growth. So all that research will be followed up in years to come. So first, we'll look at three basic steps most effective to harnessing the neuroplasticity of the brain to strengthen the functioning of the prefrontal cortex, what I call the CEO of resilience. Three very basic steps, very similar to early trauma work. One is safety, our perception of safety within ourselves, within our own body brain, which primes the neuroplasticity of the brain for learning and growth. then safety in relationships, which will activate the neuroplasticity of the brain to do what it does best, which is to learn and grow and rewire in interactions with other brains. And then 3, positive emotional experiences in relationships that channel the brain's patterns of coping into more openness, receptivity, and larger perspectives. The direct measurable outcome in the behavioral science research is resilience. And neuroscientists are also beginning to see significant correlations between the brain structures we use to cultivate positive emotions in relationships in the brains of people who measure high in post-traumatic growth. So first, safety. Safety is the most important precondition for any healing and growth, any effective therapy, essential for the recovery from trauma. Stephen Porges, the neurophysiologist whose pioneering work in the role of the vagus nerve in regulating the nervous system has taught us so much about generating a neuroception of safety in relationships, Steve says safety is the treatment. The brain's neuroplasticity is primed in its neuroception of safety, an inner bodily sense that we are safe or safe enough. When the lower body brain is reactive in our automatic survival mode, what we know as fight, flight, freeze, or numbed out, shut down, collapsed, the brain and the body are responding. The revving up of the sympathetic nervous system will get us moving towards safety or away from danger. And the collapsing of the parasympathetic will cause us to shut down, numb out, play dead so the lion won't eat you. This revving up and shutting down are 2 hallmark symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. But the prefrontal cortex of the higher brain isn't available for learning much of anything new that might be more effective or capable of overriding the old habitual patterns. When the brain is safe in its baseline physiological equilibrium, the window of tolerance in trauma therapy, it will be able to be open, receptive, engaged, able to learn new ways of responding, new, more adaptive, more resilient strategies. One of the fastest and most reliable tools we have to return to a sense of safety, a sense of calm and equilibrium in our body brain, is called hand on the heart. And it's the first exercise I teach to every client, every couple, every workshop participant, because it's so effective. It's powerful enough to calm down a panic attack in less than a minute. So you simply place your own hand on your heart center so that you can feel the warm touch of your hand on your heart. And begin to breathe a little more slowly and deeply and gently into the heart center. And if you wish, breathe in a sense of ease or goodness or safety or peace into the heart center. And then you take a moment to remember a moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished with another human being. It could be someone close to you, like a parent or a child or a partner. But it could also be a friend, or a therapist, or a coach. It could be a spiritual figure, like Jesus or the Dalai Lama, and it could also be a pet. So as you remember this one moment, not the whole relationship, but just one moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished, and you let the feeling of that memory, the feeling of that moment, wash through your body. And spend just a few seconds with the warm glow of that feeling. So when we do hand on the heart, just simply warm, safe touch anywhere on the body will begin to activate the release of oxytocin, which is the brain's hormone of safety and trust. When we breathe more deeply into the heart center, we're activating the parasympathetic branch of the nervous system in a very positive, benign way to bring more relaxation to the body. When we breathe in a sense of ease or goodness or safety or peace, we're actually putting the brakes on the survival responses of the body, returning the body to a little bit more peace and ease. And then when we remember that moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished, and we actually activate the release of oxytocin, it's the brain's direct and immediate antidote to the stress hormone cortisol. So blood pressure goes down, the heart rate stabilizes. The flow of oxytocin in the body brain is powerful enough to even preempt a stress response from happening in the first place. So I teach my clients to practice hand on the heart many times a day as they go throughout the day so that it becomes the new go-to pattern of response that the brain, we don't even have to think about doing it. It becomes the new automatic go-to. The second key point in harnessing the brain's neuroplasticity to strengthen resilience and cultivate growth is that safety is fostered in relationship. The human brain is a social organ, and people are social beings. As my mentor Diana Focia says, the roots of resilience are to be found in the felt sense of being held in the mind and heart of an empathic, attuned, and self-possessed other. And this poem by Diana Craik expresses that kind of safety in relationship. Ah, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person, having neither to weigh out thoughts nor words, but pouring them all right out, just as they are, chaff and grain together, certain that a faithful hand will take them and sift them, keeping what is worth keeping, and with the breath of kindness, blow the rest away. So the inner secure base of resilience that develops in the prefrontal cortex from that kind of safety in relationship is the best protection that a person has against stress, trauma, and later psychopathology. So we'll learn tools to evoke that sense of safety in relationships in process number 2 of the post-traumatic growth protocol that we're going through, resourcing with people. The third key factor in harnessing the brain's neuroplasticity for resilience and growth is that positivity of experiences in relationship, because the positive emotions in positive relationships shift the functioning of the brain. We've had about 25 years of neuroscience now, where brain scanning technologies allow neuroscientists to peek inside the black box of the brain and observe which structures of the brain light up and communicate with each other when we're watching the evening news or playing a musical instrument or mourning the loss of a pet. And we've had about 25 years of research now in the behavioral sciences in positive psychology, studying the effects of gratitude or practices of kindness or compassion or experiences of love and delight and joy and awe on people's behavior and their health and well-being. So the research discoveries of the 25 years of those two fields are dovetailing very, very nicely. We're learning that positive emotional experience pulls the brain out of the contraction and the reactivity of the innate negativity bias of the lower brain, out into a bigger picture, a broader perspective of the higher brain, where people can think more clearly, see the forest for the trees, be more optimistic, more collaborative, and more resilient. A direct, measurable outcome of cultivating positive emotional experiences is resilience, coping better with challenges and adversity, not just a correlation, but a direct cause and effect outcome. There's a beautiful example of this happening in the book Love 2.0 by the pioneering positive psychology researcher Barbara Fredrickson. Dr. Fredrickson found that when two people are in physical proximity, making eye contact, sharing positive emotions, and sharing feelings of mutual care and concern, the neurochemistry of the brains of the two people begins to sync up. And in that experience of connection and resonance, both people begin to experience a physiological state, a state in their bodies that they can consciously perceive and process, of what she calls love. It certainly is a state of trust in oneself, in the other person, and in connection. It's probably the oxytocin released doing an exercise like hand on the heart that causes that neural synchrony that Barbara Fredrickson is referring to in Love 2.0. So resonant connection increases positive experiences, and positive experiences between people increase resonant connection. So there might be a big duh here, but for people struggling with trauma, to learn that this is so, to learn that they can shift the functioning of their brains out of the negativity bias into positivity and into more satisfying connections can be a huge, huge breakthrough for them. And we'll explore this more in process number 3, resourcing with the positive. So now I'm going to focus a bit on resilience, which is the capacity innate in the brain of response flexibility, being able to bend with the wind or go with the flow, being able to bounce back from adversity. The response flexibility allows us to shift gears and shift perspectives and shift views. We know in the human enterprise that shit happens, but shift happens too. And as we'll learn in process number one of post-traumatic growth, awareness and acceptance of reality, mindfulness can be a very powerful practice to strengthen the capacity of resilience in the brain. When we can see clearly what's happening in the moment and our reactions to what's happening in the moment, we can more easily discern our options and choose wise action, a wise response. This capacity of resilience, coping flexibly, adaptively with any challenges and crises of our lives, is a capacity that is developed and strengthened from experience. All capacities in the brain are matured through experience, moment by moment, experience repeated over time to create and strengthen neural circuitry, the neural substrate of patterns of response in the brain. So this development of a capacity in the brain over time means three things. One, resilience is more than a genetically determined trait. Some people are born with a temperament of hardiness, grit, determination, the will to survive, the will to endure, the traditional definition of resilience. But this capacity of response flexibility is innate in the brain. It is genetically programmed to be able to be developed, but we develop it from experience. We can develop and strengthen this capacity when we know how. Two, resilience is the perception and response to an experience. It is not dependent on the experience, and it is not determined by the experience. So resilience is a capacity to respond skillfully, adaptively, flexibly to a wide variety of content, which we would call stressors. External stressors, or events like losing our car keys or losing our wallet, like having to stay home from work with a sick child for 3 days, like being in a serious car accident or causing a serious car accident. Those external events trigger an internal stress response that we have to deal with, hopefully resiliently, so that we can deal effectively with the external stressor. So internal messages can trigger a stress response that we have to deal with resiliently too. The message we tell ourselves about how stupid we are for losing the car keys and the wallet, or resentment that we might feel if we have to stay home with a sick child, or real panic we might be experiencing because of the car accident, let alone causing one. So resilience is a capacity to deal with any content. And we strengthen that capacity to deal with any external stressor and internal message, and that's what leads us into post-traumatic growth. Three, the key to resilience is to take responsibility for how we're responding to an issue. There was an excellent summary of the recent research on resilience in the February 11, 2016 issue of The New Yorker, How People Learn to Become Resilient. And it's all about taking responsibility for responding flexibly. As my colleague Frankie Perez says, how you respond to the issue, it's the issue. And other ways of saying the same thing, from the Austrian psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who spent 3.5 years in Nazi concentration camps, including Auschwitz, and afterwards wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning. Between a stimulus and a response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. The last of human freedoms is to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. And other ways of saying that, from my friend Janet Friedman, catch the moment, make a choice. And from the environmental activist Julia Butterfly Hill, every moment has a choice and every choice has an impact. So that's the trajectory that we're aiming for when we're strengthening our capacities of resilience. Catch the moment, make a choice. Every moment has a choice, every choice has an impact. Or as Jon Kabat-Zinn, the developer of mindfulness-based stress reduction, says, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. So this view of taking responsibility for our choices in response to any difficulties, any disasters, can help shift our view of ourselves from victim, poor me, to an empowered I. Very, very important in post-traumatic growth. So I'm turning the focus now to trauma so that we can move through trauma into post-traumatic growth. As Peter Levine, developer of somatic experiencing trauma therapy, says, trauma is a fact of life. It doesn't have to be a life sentence. So when I was in graduate school in clinical psychology, learning about trauma, how to diagnose it and how to treat it, I was taught, we were all taught at the time, that trauma was considered to be any event that would overwhelm the coping mechanism of the patient. So capital T trauma were events that would overwhelm the coping capacities of anyone. Combat, or being a refugee, rape, imprisonment, death of a loved one in a car accident or a natural disaster. And small T traumas were events that overwhelmed some people, but not other people. Flying in an airplane, or getting a root canal, or being stuck in an elevator, or witnessing an armed robbery. But the trauma researchers began to notice that not everybody responded to the same events in the same way. One person would lose a job and get derailed in their career for 6 months. They would be traumatized, paralyzed, immobilized, not coping resiliently or taking action. Another person in a similar circumstance, maybe even doing the same job, maybe even losing the same job, within 2 months might have found a new career path. They had not only coped resiliently, they had come through to the other side in a better position in their life. They had grown. So pioneering researchers in the field, like Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun, found that people could grow. They could find a new direction for their life from the most horrendous of traumas. The death of a child, being a prisoner of war, suffering a debilitating stroke. The definition of trauma began to shift from the event itself, that the event was the trauma, to the person's response to the event. That person, if a person's coping was overwhelmed, if they couldn't cope and didn't cope, then their response to the event was a trauma response. The event was traumatizing to them. This view is very related to the understanding of the human stress response. So for instance, there's an external event, there's an external stressor, and then there's an internal stress response to that stressor. So say I'm following in the car ahead of me too closely, they stop suddenly, I rear-end them, and my body brain goes into an internal stress response. My heart starts racing, the muscles tense, my thinking brain shuts down because of the external event. And if I stayed shut down, not recovering and coping, I would be experiencing a trauma response. Similarly, if someone responds to the death of a parent or a spouse by completely shutting down and not coping, not the natural sorrow and mourning of grief of devastating loss, but becoming devastated, not functioning, then they're having a trauma response to the event, they're being traumatized by the death. Another person could experience a similar death of someone very close to them, go through all the grief and all the coping necessary, but not be traumatized. They could cope resiliently with a potentially traumatizing event, but not be traumatized. They could even be woken up and shaken up, catalyzed into a new sense of themselves, the importance of relationship, the importance of every precious moment, and embark on a deeper direction in other relationships. It's that shift, noticing that it's the internal response of the person to any event that determines whether the person is experiencing trauma or not. When people are not well-resourced and vulnerable, perhaps because of previously traumatizing events, they can experience a trauma response to anything. If someone criticizes their cooking, or their parenting, they could go into a paralyzing shame trauma response. In post-traumatic growth, there is a process of rebuilding and rediscovering who you are in a world where bad things happen to good people that fosters new meaning, new purpose, new direction for people, not just bouncing back, but moving into a new sense of fulfillment and thriving. And that's the growth. So I've been talking about acute trauma. One discrete event, even if that is a very potentially devastating event, and people might use a trauma therapy like EMDR to deal with that discrete event. There's also developmental trauma, where less than optimal experiences in the family of origin derail the full maturation of the prefrontal cortex, compromising the inner secure base of resilience that is the best buffer we have against stress, trauma, and later psychopathology. So people might go into an attachment trauma therapy like accelerated experiential dynamic psychotherapy and do the reparenting, the recovering of that internal secure base. There's complex developmental trauma. If a child experiences too many of what are called adverse childhood experiences, neglect, abuse, violence in the home, there's a demonstrable cognitive impairment and social emotional impairment. And when self-regulation and memory are compromised, there can be a downward spiral, one trauma creating even more vulnerability to another trauma. So then therapeutic modalities like sensory motor, psychotherapy, or somatic experiencing can be used to deal with many, many layers of trauma. There can be an accumulation of trauma, too many acute traumas occurring too rapidly, one right after the other, leading to a global dysfunction of post-traumatic stress disorder. Both the numbing out and the isolating and the overreactivity, the nightmares and the flashbacks. And then definitely a body-based trauma therapy is necessary to help stabilize the nervous system out of the post-traumatic stress. But post-traumatic growth researchers Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun found that even among people who survived a plane crash or lost a child in a car accident or were detained in a prisoner of war camp or in a refugee camp, people whose lives were completely upheavaled by losing a limb or by losing their financial security, many such people could still move through the trauma, could find a new perspective in their lives, and choose to create changes in their lives that not only overcame the trauma, but set the course of their life in a completely new direction. So they found that while 75% of all Americans will experience at least one potentially traumatizing event in their lifetime, only 8% will develop full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder, the seemingly intractable symptoms of hyperarousal, flashbacks, nightmares, or hypoarousal, numbing out, withdrawal, isolation, and depression. They found that more than half of all people experiencing at least one potentially traumatizing event will fully recover, meaning that they have a renewed sense of meaning and purpose in their life, a deeper sense of fulfillment and contentment in their life, and not just in spite of the trauma, but as radical as it sounds, from the process of recovering from the trauma. That last piece, that people experience growth because of their journey of recovering from trauma, not just getting to the other side of the event and being okay in spite of the event, but growth because of the process of recovery. That is the contribution of post-traumatic growth research to our understanding and practice of resilience and even trauma therapy. So now we want to explore how neuroscience can inform our use of tools and techniques to support not only resilience, but post-traumatic growth. So these are the five processes of post-traumatic growth: awareness and acceptance of reality and the consequences of reality, resourcing with people, sharing the story, sharing the struggle, resourcing with the positive, reframing the negative, creating a coherent narrative, and appreciating the new life because of the trauma, not just in spite of it. All five of those steps are very big processes. They have many, many steps within them, drawing on different tools from different paradigms, and they can be repeated many times over time. But these are the processes that will lead people to the outcomes of post-traumatic growth: an increased sense of one's personal strengths, a sense of new opportunities, new possibilities, deeper relationships, both intimately with specific people, socially, or even a sense of common humanity, and a greater appreciation of life and all the possibilities of life. So we'll go through these one by one, starting with number one, awareness and acceptance of reality. The sense that this happened, never should have, not fair, the consequences are devastating and recovery could take years. We wake up to bad things happen to good people, that we cannot do enough or be good enough to protect ourselves or our loved ones from the possibility, even the likelihood, of tragedy, trouble, and trauma. Researchers have found that it can be particularly difficult for Americans to not only have their lives blown apart by the truly awful, but to have their worldview of how the world is supposed to work blown apart. If you work hard enough and follow the rules and take care, you should be able to avoid and prevent bad things from happening to you and your loved ones. And that's not what's true. So William James, the founder of American psychology, said many, many years ago, "Be willing to have it so. Acceptance of what has happened is the first step to overcoming the consequences of any misfortune." And I don't know of any practice from any paradigm more powerful to help people be aware of and accept reality as it is than the Mindful Self-Compassion Protocol developed by Kristen Neff at University of Texas Austin and Christopher Germer at Harvard. So in that protocol, the mindfulness will focus our awareness on our experience. May I accept this moment exactly as it is? And the self-compassion focuses kindness on ourselves as the experiencer. May I accept myself exactly as I am in this moment? There's an element of common humanity which is so important for moving into post-traumatic growth. I'm not the only one, and I'm not alone. And those three processes together will activate the caregiving system within the person so that we can shift from reactivity and contraction to openness and engagement. So I'll teach here just one tool of the more than 50 tools available in the Mindful Self-Compassion Protocol. It's the self-compassion break, and it's very, very useful, simple to do, powerful in its impact. So in terms of practicing it here, you would bring to mind some worry, some upset, some distress that's current for you now, and you bring it to awareness so that you can be aware of the experience of it in your body, aware of your own reactions, whether you're feeling tense or contracted, whether you're revved up or shut down. And then you place your own hand on your heart or on your cheek, and the warm, safe touch is calming to the nervous system. And whatever distress you're focusing in on, you come into a compassionate awareness of, ouch, this is hard, or this is scary, or I don't like this. Whatever speaks to your own emotional experience in the moment. Lately, I've been saying to myself, frankly, I'm not happy. And that brings my awareness to my own state. And then saying silently to yourself phrases similar to, may I be kind to myself in this moment. May I accept this moment exactly as it is. And that mindful awareness of reality is one of the key factors that helps people recover from trauma. May I accept myself exactly as I am in this moment. And Carl Rogers 50 years ago said, the curious paradox is, when I accept myself exactly as I am, then I can change. And then to wish yourself, may I give myself all the compassion and courageous action that I need. So these phrases bring us to a state of focus, of consciousness, of awareness, of acceptance, of compassion, caring for ourselves in the moment that we're experiencing the suffering. And that's what shifts the functioning of the brain to be able to discern wise options and take wise action again. When I do this practice for myself, I further modify it. So I may say, may I be kind to myself in this moment. May I be kind to myself in any moment. May I be kind to myself in every moment. And that allows me to open up my thinking again to be more resilient. So practicing mindful self-compassion might also lead to a need to practice forgiveness for one's self, for any responsibility, for any disaster that has happened. Especially if something tragic has happened to another innocent human being. Forgiveness also brings the brain out of contraction, hostility, grudge, resentment, any states of mind that hamper the neuroplasticity of the brain to learn anything new. So the second step in this post-traumatic growth protocol is resourcing with people. And there are several different phrases. There are several different phases to doing this. The first is to be able to seek out people as a refuge, as a resource of safety and protection, finding people who love us, who care about us, who believe in our resilience, and who believe in our recovery and growth, people who encourage us to never give up, people who help us hang in through the disorientation that so frequently we experience in any catastrophe, even when the impact continues to be felt day after day after day after day. People who don't give up, but who also don't need anything from us. They don't need us to be a certain way or move at a certain pace. They're actually just compassionate companions to our recovery process. They allow us and support us in being with whatever we need to be aware of and to be with it and to accept it. So spending time with safe, caring, supportive people, even if not a lot of words are spoken, can generate that neurochemical synchrony that Barbara Fredrickson discovered when people are in close physical proximity, making eye contact, sharing positive emotions, sharing feelings of mutual care and concern that evokes a sense of love and safety. The second step then is finding people who can act as a support or even resource to us. And here I'm focusing on being able to share our story, telling other people what has happened, how we're coping, and how we feel received or understood or supported by their listening, which is why support groups can be so helpful. A community of other people with the same trauma, people who have been there and who know, where we don't have to explain or defend anything. And that camaraderie and common humanity can help us want to stay on the planet. We can stop feeling sorry for ourselves and engage with and even help others in the same struggle. So it's important to remember the sage advice of Brené Brown, author of Rising Strong and Daring Greatly, to share your story with people who have earned the right to hear it. So I will often ask people that I'm working with, besides sharing their story in general, to share moments when they have found courage in hard times. And that could be something current, it could be something last month, it could be something back in the third grade. But sharing with another person a time when you found the courage to meet and deal with something scary, difficult, potentially overwhelming. Specific times and specific moments. Not necessarily how you did that, but it could be, but just when you did that, finding previous moments of courage in your own life journey. And one exercise, that's a good exercise to do with other people, but when other people aren't necessarily available in the moment, a very good exercise to be able to have that compassionate companioning internally is to be able to do an exercise of evoking the compassionate friend. It's a guided meditation to evoke a resource of our own intuitive wisdom and comfort in times of difficulty or danger. It's also part of the Mindful Self-Compassion Protocol. It's taught all over the world. And it's very, very simple. I'm going to describe it more than actually lead you in it, but you can begin to imagine how powerful this could be. If you sit in a comfortable posture and allow yourself to come into a sense of presence, of just being with yourself in your body, with your experience in the moment, and focusing your awareness on the gentle rhythm of your own breathing, coming into a sense of relaxation and peacefulness. And then when you're ready, imagining that you're in your own safe place, a place that's comfortable for you, where you can feel safe and protected, at ease and content. This may be a room in your own home. It may be a park and a bench. It may be a bench in a park. It may be on a hill overlooking the beach. It may be in a cafe with a friend. You let yourself settle into the safety and comfort of being in your own safe place. Then you let yourself know that you're going to receive a visitor, someone who is older, wiser, stronger, someone who honestly cares about you a great deal. They know you and they care about your suffering. And they want you to be happy and they want to spend a little time with you. So you imagine this compassionate friend in quite some detail, what they look like, how they're dressed, how they move, especially what it feels like to you to be in their presence, in their energy field. And you imagine how you meet and greet them. Do you stand up and shake hands? Do you hug and do you bow? And then you imagine, you know that you're going to have a conversation with this person in your imagination, so you imagine how you do that, whether you sit down next to each other or across from each other or you go for a walk. And then you bring to mind something worrisome to you, something that's a little upsetting or distressing to you right now in your life in the moment. Not the biggest worry, but something where you can feel the sense of discomfort or unease in your own body. And then you get to share with this compassionate friend this worry, this upset, this distress that's current for you now. And you imagine giving voice to this concern, being able to share this concern with your compassionate friend. And you imagine your compassionate friend listening receptively, openly, understandingly. You imagine how you feel being listened to and understood and accepted by this compassionate friend. And then you imagine any words of acceptance or encouragement or support that your compassionate friend might have to say. If you could hear the words right now that would be the words exactly that you need to hear, what would those words be? And then imagine listening. Imagine how you feel as you hear those words from your compassionate friend. And when the conversation is complete and it's time for the compassionate friend to depart for now, you imagine how you say goodbye, knowing that you can visit with this compassionate friend again anytime you wish to. And after your compassionate friend has departed and you're in your safe place again with yourself, you take a moment to pause and notice and reflect on your experience. Reflect on any shifts in your experience of yourself or any shifts of the upset you were working with, knowing that you've tapped into your own deep intuitive wisdom. Then the third phase of resourcing with people is sharing your story with a larger audience and experiencing other people hearing your story, validating your experience, even learning from you how you coped, how you found your own strengths and your own resilience in the journey. Doing that, not that we have to explain, but we get to explain what happened, that strengthens our own sense of competence and mastery and efficacy. We get to have a sense of ourselves, I am coping, I am growing and learning, I can change in real and significant ways. So this resourcing with other people is an important transition from needing a refuge, a place to retreat and regroup, to feeling understood and supported and accepted, to re-engaging with the world, becoming a contributing member to the larger society again with whatever we have learned on our particular trauma and our particular journey recovering from it. Step three of this post-traumatic growth protocol, resourcing with the positive and reframing the negative. So it may seem completely counterintuitive at first to try to find positive moments in the midst of a catastrophe. And we certainly don't do that to avoid being with or having compassion for our fear and our grief or the agony of the experience. There's a very legitimate suffering in the struggle with trauma. But finding moments of respite in a warm cup of coffee, in the smile of a friend, in a walk in the park, in playing with a puppy, in the sound of a bird or seeing a sunny blue sky, that's essential to shift the functioning of the brain out of contraction, reactivity, and rumination into possibilities and a larger perspective. A temporary respite from unbearable uncertainty, fear, and grief. Finding a space to breathe and regroup in the midst of a very difficult effort. We'll do an exercise to focus on the positive in the moment. But I want to say here first, when thoughts, feelings, and sensations really begin to seem unworkable, one tool that is invaluable and often undervalued is that of skillful distraction. Being able to shift the focus of attention, switch the channel, not distracting into denial or dissociation, but taking a time out, watching a favorite TV show, or cooking a good meal, or working out at the gym. Skillful distraction is a skill, and when we're mindful, wisely discerning whether indeed we're creating a refuge or going into denial, we can shift our focus and attention, we can shift our physical energy, we do something different, we move in a different way, and then when we feel settled and grounded again, then we can return to exploring the difficult feeling or memory. So now returning to resourcing with the positive. One excellent way to bring the brain and the sense of self out of contraction, reactivity, out of the negativity bias of the brain, which the traumatizing event may have triggered big time, is a practice of gratitude. Gratitude is one of the easiest ways to get the brain to shift into a more open, receptive perspective. And here we use gratitude to begin to identify one past event that triggered a trauma response in us at the time. We can go back now and find something in the event or in the recovery from the event to be grateful for. And again, this is not to be pie in the sky or Pollyanna. It is never to minimize or push away the real misery and confusion or impact of the traumatic event. We are aware, we accept, we are resourcing. But the new meaning, the new purpose that is the hallmark of post-traumatic growth may hinge on our capacity to develop, finding the gift in the mistake, turning a regrettable moment into a teachable moment, beginning to see the positive meaning in a negative event. So with people, I would do this exercise as a written reflection, just one or two sentences about the event itself, that's all. But most of the writing is on what you learned from the event or what you learned from recovering from the event, how you're changed because of it, what the silver lining of the event was, or what the silver lining of the process of recovering from the event was. And then if you like, of course, you can share that with safe, trusted people or in small groups of people. So that exercise of finding the gift or the meaning in the event is a springboard for the fourth process of post-traumatic growth, which is creating a coherent narrative. It's a much, much larger process. So Stephen Joseph, pioneering researcher in post-traumatic growth, psychologist at the University of Nottingham, says the ability to abandon the old assumptive self or narrative and to develop a new one is at the heart of the process that can result in post-traumatic growth. People are always telling themselves stories. It is how we make sense of the significance of what has happened to us. In the wake of trauma, people are often telling themselves stories of mental defeat and hopelessness, and they need to be in a position to begin reframing their story as one that looks to the future and begins to view things in a beneficial way. And another perspective from Rachel Yehuda, director of the Traumatic Stress Studies Division at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Trauma causes changes. There are a lot of opinions out there about how that change manifests, but you just don't stay the same. And that is a really radical idea. You do discover in some ways, you do recover in some ways, but that recovery doesn't actually involve returning to the baseline. It involves recalibration towards something new. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a way of describing that in a very negative light. And post-traumatic growth is a way of describing that in a very positive light. So the coherent narrative is an exercise to help people rewrite the story of the trauma and thus the story of themselves. They can let go of stories that are not so helpful, not so skillful, not so resourceful. They can let go of the stories that keep people caught in the feelings or the beliefs about the trauma or because of the trauma. And they can create a new narrative of life that integrates the trauma into their life story. So coherent narrative is a big tool, and it may take a long time to do this reflection and write the narrative. It can be done many times. The coherent narrative uses a process in the brain called deliberate rumination. When we're not focusing the attention of the brain on a specific task, the functioning of the brain defaults to what neuroscientists call the default mode network, the mental play space of the brain where the brain is playing. It's making its own associations and links. It's connecting the dots in a new way on its own. It's the mode of the brain that we're in when we daydream or go into a reverie. Of course, being in this mode can cause problems when someone is overwhelmed by trauma. It is the realm of worry and rumination where we can chew on something over and over. But trauma researchers are finding that asking patients to use a deliberate tool of rumination, the coherent narrative, actually helps people make new associations and connect the dots in new ways in a very positive, productive way. Deliberate rumination is a different kind of thought process, one driven by the individual, not by the trauma. It is not wallowing or obsession. When someone is deliberately ruminating on a problem, he is actively involved in thinking about how the event has impacted him, what it means for him, and how he can live his life going forward, given the challenges that the event has posed. When deliberately ruminating, the trauma survivor is actively tackling the challenges that the trauma has introduced into its world. Deliberate rumination is the way that people begin to rebuild themselves. Deliberate rumination can allow a trauma survivor. Deliberate rumination can allow a trauma survivor to construct a new view of themselves and the world. Deliberate rumination is at the heart of growth. It's an important process that allows trauma survivors to find new narratives for their lives, new ways of understanding their strengths and possibilities, and more meaningful ways to live. So this reflection, the coherent narrative, places an entire event in a timeline of the entire lifetime. There was the event, but there was also a before, and there's an after. Trauma is part of the story, but it's not the whole story. And trauma is included in the story, but doesn't define the life story. And trauma has a place in the story without determining the whole story. So when I lead people in doing this exercise, I may take several hours or several different sessions to do this exercise. So here, we're just going to describe it. But you would identify an event that you want to work with. And I always suggest for practice that people identify an event that happened in the past, something that's already been processed, something that they've already learned from. It's important to work with something that doesn't have so much risk of re-traumatizing or re-triggering them, to stay in that safety so that the brain can perceive they're safe and be primed to be open to learning and change. So you can see the prompts. This is what happened, and these were the consequences. So again, mindfulness and self-compassion are really key to be able to come to that observer awareness and acceptance and relate to the event somewhat objectively rather than caught in the trauma response. These were the resources, practices, tools, and coping strategies I used at the time. So an honest awareness and acceptance, no shame, blame, but also recovering the strengths and resources that we did have at the time. These are the resources, practices, tools, and coping strategies that I would use now if I could do this over, because there has been new growth and there has been new learning, and this step integrates that learning. These were the lessons I learned, the growth I experienced, the positive meanings I found. And asking people to take a lot of time with this, because this is the turning point of the post-traumatic growth process. And then the last step, this is what I now appreciate because of the event. So again, that post-traumatic growth is more than coping. It is learning. It is redeeming. It is thriving. And this step may take some time also, but it's the hallmark of fully recovering from trauma. So James Pennebaker, who's chair of the Department of Psychology at the University of Texas, Austin, found that reflecting through journaling, through an exercise like this, can be a very effective way of making sense of our story, because the brain processes information and experience differently when we're remembering to ourselves, from when we're talking to somebody else, from when we're writing about the experience. That writing requires processing in the higher brain, in the left hemisphere of the brain, the verbal, sequential, symbolic centers of the brain. So when we write about our experiences, we're actually creating a little distance between ourselves and the experience. We activate the observing ego or the witness awareness, and we can be less caught in the emotional turmoil of the experience. And then the last step, appreciating the new life direction because of the event, that's the hardest part of the trajectory of post-traumatic growth. So I'm going to repeat the quote that I used earlier from Richard Tedeschi. Because there is no returning to baseline for people whose worlds have been upended by trauma, a traumatic event is not simply a hardship to be overcome. The trauma becomes a dividing line in people's lives. It can catalyze deep transformation. People do more than survive, they become wise. And to quote my friend Michaela Haas in her book, Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs, post-traumatic stress is a catalyst for the emotional growth. The worst has happened and we are changed. Let's face it, few of us ever live our best and kindest lives. Most of us hurtle along, propelled by bills and responsibilities, somewhat impervious to our true potential. A breakdown also breaks down the musts and the should-haves that ruled our daily routines, along with the life as we knew it. Temporarily suspended in a vacuum, we can recalibrate, and maybe for the first time, tune into what truly matters. As we tune into what truly matters, we activate what is called prospective memory in the brain, the capacity to set an intention, make a plan, and take action steps toward fulfilling that plan, even if our actions are disrupted or delayed. Neuroscientists have found a correlation between better functioning of this capacity in the brain and higher measures of post-traumatic growth. So post-traumatic growth research focuses on the aftermath of the trauma event, not the event itself. The event is a catalyst for a cascade of reactions. And as a result of that cascade of reactions, there's a real rebuilding opportunity, meeting the world again with newly learned skills of coping, taking action and engaging with the world in some kind of volunteer activity or artistic or creative endeavor. And as with the ordinary living of our lives, as with cultivating the resilience that allows us to meet the difficulties and challenges of our lives skillfully and flexibly, post-traumatic growth is an active, choiceful process that allows us to use the strengthened functioning of our prefrontal cortex, that CEO of resilience, to cope with the extraordinary disasters of our lives, to learn from them, to grow, and even triumph. As Helen Keller says, all the world is full of suffering. It is also full of overcoming. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Linda. I love the way that you frame this because I think so many of us associate trauma or post-trauma experience with more stress and not so much growth and flourishing.
It's not to say that there's not stress and challenge and difficulty and pain and anguish when there's trauma. But that's why it's important to find people who can be with us even in those moments of stress. Important to find positive moments even in those moments of stress. Important to start to find our own strengths and capacities to cope with the stress and the anguish of trauma so that we begin to find new strengths and new meaning and new purpose. So that's simply positing the possibility of that. The researchers say there's no guarantee, but there's the possibility that that kind of growth could happen. And when we see the possibility, then we have hope, and then we have motivation, and then we have courage, and we keep going.
Well, and as you mentioned, it's certainly a choiceful approach. I want to talk a little bit about that, actually, because you mentioned shifting from the victimized me or the traumatized me to the empowered I. Can you say a little bit about what that process looks like and who is the empowered I? Is it the idealized future version of myself?
You know, when we are impacted by a trauma and we can collapse, the victim stance is essentially a collapse of our nervous system. So we're not activating as much as we need to on our own behalf. We can go into and stay in a lot of shame, blame. If this hadn't happened, if that hadn't happened, so and so. And we get paralyzed by being caught in that sense of shame and blame. So the shifting to the empowerment of an agentic I is not necessarily having to take responsibility for what happened, though sometimes for people in trauma, there is the task of taking responsibility for their part in it, and that can be difficult. But it's taking responsibility for the reactions, for the responses, for how we're coping, so that we do less focusing on the event and who's to blame for that, and on the impact and how bad it feels, and start focusing more on, so what are my choices now? What resources do I need now? What people do I need in my life now? What kind of help and support and encouragement do I need now? And when we activate in that way, we're activating the brain out of the reactivity, contraction, shutdown, narrow focus of the negativity bias. And we're opening back out to a sense more of being able to cope. Resilience is one of the outcomes of this, being able to cope, having a larger picture, pulling in more people to help us. So we actually activate the brain then to be able to think and come up with new ideas or discern which options might serve us the best. So we're actually moving out of a very narrow focus of brain functioning to a much larger, more comprehensive, more capable functioning in our brain. And from there, we can be more resilient.
We're doing a lot of internal work in this process, and I wonder how we might go about using some of these practices to create safe environments where maybe some of our tormentors might be. say, if we have a hostile boss at work, or there are people in our families who aren't so supportive of this new growth, what would you suggest for that, for healing in those conditions?
Christy, that's a big question. So when we do this inner work to recover our own inner secure base of resilience, and we do that in safety, we do it with other people who are safe, we do that pulling in the resources that will rewire our brain in a wholesome direction. When we do that inner work and we become more resilient ourselves, partly because our brain is becoming more resilient, then we're more able to perceive and discern, well, what people can we work with in a different way? What people might we have to set a limit or a boundary with? Sometimes people will be able to take their own sense of empowerment, courage, safety, calm, and compassion, and begin to affect or entrain other people rather than being brought into other people's anxiety or fear or hostility. We can entrain people in our own sense of competence, of equanimity, of equilibrium, of compassion. But we can also better discern who's going to be available and open for that, and who maybe do we try next year after we've had a little more practice with the people who are more open and receptive. One of the things that's really key about brain change is that the brain learns best little and often. Small experiences repeated over and over again. That's how the brain learns best. So, as I will often say, the brain is more impacted if we meditate 10 minutes a day every day than if we meditate for an hour on the weekend. Or if we practice gratitude every night, we write in our journal three things that we're grateful for, rather than saving it up for half an hour on the weekend. So if we work with how the brain works little and often, then we can begin to experiment in small ways. If I make a suggestion to you about change, are you going to be receptive? If I speak up at this meeting, how effective am I? Did people respond? We begin little and often because that's really how change is going to happen. We need to have some success in feeling our own growth and feeling our own strengths, feeling our own competence to be able then to convey that and affect other people with that. So, they're in post-traumatic growth when they're doing the research, it may just be someone participates in an art class, or they join a sports team, or they speak at a local neighborhood gathering. They don't necessarily have to address all of the issues facing our nation or this planet all at once, but to begin to get the sense of growth and meaning in the new small directions. That's what I would suggest.
You touched on my next question when you mentioned things that are going on in the country right now. I'm sure you've heard lots of people express frustration or a feeling of defeat or overwhelm at a lot of the news that's coming out from the media and the different political outlets. And I wonder what might some of those small and frequent practices be to help us with our own diet from, say, social media or the news or whatever it is outside of us that's coming in and adding to our own anxiety.
Okay, so I'm going to answer that in a couple of different directions. I've been teaching a lot on resilience and post-traumatic growth since our elections last fall. And so one of the things I try to convey to people is that similar to mindfulness, which is a process, it's a capacity that allows us to be aware of many, many different kinds of content, our body sensations, our emotions, our thoughts, our states of mind, our states of being, our identities. But the mindfulness holds any of those different complexifying contents. Compassion can be offered to many, many different categories of people. And we start with the ones closest to us and easiest to us, and then expand it out to harder and harder categories of people. Resilience is a capacity that can hold any content. And so we practice being resilient, perhaps when we're stuck in traffic or someone just shot us a dirty look over the dinner table. We practice with any content so that we can expand our resilience to larger and larger, more complex content. So in the trainings that I've been doing recently, people can come in feeling very overwhelmed, destabilized, completely discouraged, just flattened and scared by what they perceive happening with the shifts in our political landscape. And we begin by getting that sense of safety in the body, getting a sense of safety with the person sitting next to you, getting a sense of empowerment. I can talk about when I found courage before, when I found joy before, when I've had compassion or gratitude before, starting from the inside out and the bottom up. Because when people are stable in their own secure base, that's when they can begin to have a difference in the larger landscape. So that's what I'm teaching everywhere. Now, in terms of what you just said about being bombarded by television images and social media and everything that, you know, we react with the lower brain, we react with our survival responses of the amygdala. Barbara Fredrickson, in her book Positivity, suggested being very, very careful with your media diet. A minute a day, 5 minutes on the weekend. You don't have to watch all of the news. You really don't have to. You be careful what you put into your brain, because you're going to have to manage everything you put into your brain. And instead, stay focused on the small events, you know, where the neighbor helps another neighbor or a teacher, you know, helps a kid graduate from high school. You stay focused on the positive news of humanity, the positive ways people are helping each other, and then be very careful how much you allow yourself to be thrown off your own center. It's just extremely important that we're mindful of our own minds and the clarity and the integrity of our own minds. It's up to us to manage our own nervous system. I mean, we're responsible for managing the survival responses of our nervous system. So if things get overwhelming watching the 10 o'clock news at night before you go to bed, then don't do that. Make love or play with your cat instead.
I like that. I can do that.
Great.
Can you talk a little bit about a suggestion that you offered in your book, Bouncing Back? Mm-hmm. You suggested that we do something scary every day. Can you talk about the importance of expanding the comfort zone and going into that kind of nervy territory?
Right. So I teach, thank you for the question. I teach a lot about using oxytocin, the hormone of safety and trust, to calm down the nervous system. And it does. It's very powerful. But another way that we can get through this signal anxiety that we, anytime we face something new or unknown, let alone something scary, is to go ahead and take action and experience ourselves meeting the anxiety, not as a signal to stop, but as a signal to try. And so doing one scary thing a day simply begins to train the brain, simply begins to recondition the brain, that when the anxiety comes up, and that's natural, anytime we have to move to a new job or move to a new city or just even go to a new restaurant, that signal anxiety will come up in the brain. And it doesn't necessarily mean anything is bad or wrong. It's just a cue to pay attention. So if we train our brains to pay attention and say, okay, got the signal, what can I do? And over time, we begin to get the sense inside of our own body brain, oh, I got it, anxiety, I'll do something. So the mindful reflection is still helpful and important to discern what it is that we're going to be doing. But Angelus Arian used to say that action is the cure for anxiety. So we meet whatever signal we're getting from our body with the decision to go ahead and try acting. And then it's that retraining the brain. Oh, I got it. I'm scared. I'll figure out what to do. That's really, really building our resilience again.
Linda, how important is it that we know exactly what the source of our trauma is or was? Because I know personally, sometimes I might be in a certain situation where I'll feel just a tightening or a resistance to a particular situation. And I wonder how I might be able to give myself more to the experience as opposed to withdrawing.
So what's important about however much information we have about a traumatizing event and whatever the story is about the traumatizing event? The key piece is our story about ourselves. The key piece is how we are relating to ourselves in relationship to that trauma. So that's why mindfulness and self-compassion are so key for moving into post-traumatic growth. It's not just aware of what happened and the story I have about what happened. It's how aware I am of me and what story am I creating? And do I have the resources to create a different story? Can I work with the sensations in my body? Can I work with the emotions in my body? What resources do I need to strengthen myself to be able to work with my own experience? Because that's the key to responding to trauma, to responding to any adversity. So we come back to that's why when I work with my clients, and I do a lot of trauma work with my clients, they don't have to have the whole story, but they do have to have a sense of themselves and how they're responding and how they want to be able to respond, because that's where the power is to work to make a difference. So it's focusing on our own experience of ourselves and the story that we're telling ourselves about ourselves.
Linda, we've got time for one final question. Okay. And I would like to go back, actually, to bouncing back and some of the suggestions that you offered for facing the day with some gentle practices. Can you take us out with one of those practices that you offer?
Well, I think I told the story in the book of a client, Sean, who would wake up in anxiety and fear every morning and began a practice of whatever he had to do, mindfulness, self-compassion, loving kindness, to come back to his own center, to come back to a sense of safety and well-being, and not get out of bed until he had done that, because there really wasn't much point of going off into the day if you're not safe in your own center. So at first it would take like an hour, and then it took 30 minutes, and then it took 20 minutes and 5 minutes. And finally he could wake up in that sense of well-being. And then he goes from that sense of well-being out to meet whatever is going to happen in the day. So I would try to always begin the day with a sense of self-appreciation or self-kindness, a sense of gratitude or a sense of awe for even just being alive. Coming back to that sense of the physiological equilibrium that is called the window of tolerance, it's called the range of resilience, coming back to a state that is relaxed and calm, yet engaged and alert. And if that means meditating, if that means a hot cup of tea, if that means petting the cat or loving your husband, whatever it means, really tuning into a state of well-being before you have to engage with anything else. So there are practices of hand on the heart, or, you know, you can massage your head or massage your feet. Warm, safe touch is really, really good. Safe movement is really good. Just focusing on breathing in a relaxed, gentle way. You're really getting your body, brain centered before you go out and engage at a higher level.
Linda, thank you so much for this presentation. It's been really enlightening.
Thank you. Thank you, Kristen. Thank you for the questions. I enjoyed that part.
As did I. This concludes the 14th session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Thank you again, Linda Graham, for this outstanding presentation. Please note that the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. I'd also like to thank everyone who joined us. We certainly enjoyed your participation as well. Please join us for our next live session with Mona Fishbane, which will take place tomorrow on March 27th, 2017 at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples. Thank you so much again for joining us. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey.